Hi, welcome back to another episode of Real World Serverless, a podcast where I speak with real world practitioners and get their stories from the trenches. Today, I'm honored to be joined by Charity Majors, one of my personal heroes. Hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so good to see your face. It's been a long time.
I know it's been, a few years since we met each other in London, all the way back. Like I said, you were one of my personal heroes, and the talks that you did about observability was very much, a turning point for me in terms of how I think about running systems and how I think about troubleshooting and things like that. But before I give away all the good stuff, do you mind maybe want to talk about yourself, introduce yourself, how you got from PaaS to Facebook to starting up Honeycomb?
Sure. Yeah. Well, let's see. I have interesting origins, I guess, kind of non-traditional. I was homeschooled in the backwoods of Idaho, dropped out of every schooling I've ever had. Late in life, diagnosed with ADHD, which surprised no one but me. I've always been kind of an operations engineer. I really love the the intensity and excitement of production and things that are happening right now. I've always kind of made a career niche for myself out of, I really like to be the first infrastructure engineer that joins a group of software engineers when they've got something that they think is maybe a real thing, right? And that's what I was doing at PaaS. I joined pre-beta, it was mobile backend as a service. Long live PaaS. I will never forgive Facebook. Facebook killed it. Despite the fact that it was growing, we had over a million mobile apps hosted on PaaS by the time I left. I joined PaaS, I think, in 2011. We were acquired in 2012 or 2013. I left Facebook in, I think, 2015. And in 2016, Zuck pulled the plug on it. And it turned out that the only reason they had ever acquired PaaS was because some PM at one point on the platform engineering team was like, Zuck, developers hate our platform. And together they were like, what companies out there that do developers love that we can buy and tape onto our platform engineering team so that developers will love us again? And so they were looking at, this is 2012, right? They were looking at PaaS and Docker. They ended up buying PaaS, sat us next to the platform team. Platform team was like, hi, we're all a team now. How can we make developers not hate us? And our API guy was obviously like, well, I can fix this for you. Stop making breaking changes to your APIs and SDKs. And they were like, interesting idea. We're definitely not going to do that. Do you have any other ideas for us? And we were like, no. So they moved us out of platform. They moved us over to infrastructure. Then they moved us over to somewhere else. Like, we never lived in any department for more than like 6 months. We're just being passed around like a hot potato. And all the time, all that while, like, we shipped this great open PaaS initiative where we open sourced a version of the API. We did this partnership with Docker. Platform kept growing, but there was no strategic alignment with Facebook whatsoever. Like, there never was. So anybody out there who is like, woo, I'm going to sell my startup, I have one very important thing for you to remember, which is strategic alignment. Do you have any? And do you have an executive sponsor who is not the CEO? We didn't have an executive sponsor. In fact, the execs of Facebook found out about this the same day that we did at PaaS. This was cooked up by Zuck and, like I said, a PM on the platform team. The two of them were like, cool, let's spend $100 million on this startup. And all the execs were like, the fuck? So never join a big company if you do not have a stalwart someone on the executive team who is personally invested in your success over the long term. Anyway, PaaS gets me going, man. In 2015, Zuck sold. And this is why I won't forgive it. I get it. The strategies change. Priorities change. You know, we're all adults here. The reason I will never forgive Facebook, or Zuck in particular, is that he pulled the plug on PaaS instead of selling it. There are plenty of big companies out there who wanted to buy it. Microsoft wanted to buy it. Google was interested in it, you know, and they were just like, nope, not worth the cost of the paperwork. We're just going to kill it. So anyway, at the end of 2015, I loved Parse so much, but it was just, you know, I believe that I cared longer than the actual founders did. This was not really healthy. My body started kind of breaking down. I was like projectile vomiting in the morning as I was trying to make myself go get on the shuttle. And finally I was just like, I can't, I've got to, my partner was like, you have to leave. And so I did. And you know, beginning of 2016, I was planning on going to be an engineering manager or at like Slack or Stripe or something. I had a couple of experiences that I will tell you privately over drinks someday, probably won't recount in this podcast, of very specific things that were said to me by very specific people in the industry that made my blood boil. So that happened. Somebody approached me about being a co-founder at their startup, and I was just like, interesting. I've never thought of this. I've never been one of those kids who's like, I'm going to start a company someday, because I kind of low-key despise those people. Not all of them, but like the ones who are just like, being a founder is like the, you know, I just, ugh, gross.
We're going to change the world.
I'm going to change the world. Like, fuck you. You are not. Haven't you seen Silicon Valley? Like, you're a parody of yourself. But when I was leaving Facebook, for the first time in my lifetime, like I said, career dropout, right? I've always been the stars. For the first time in my lifetime, I think I had a bit of a, what you call a pedigree. And some investors, some seed stage investors were like reaching out to me, like, would you like some money to start something? And I was kind of like, I don't know. I just felt almost morally obligated on behalf of all women and queers and dropouts in the world to take the money and run. Cause I'm like, this is never going to happen again. So I took the money and I ran. But in fact, there was this problem that we had encountered. You know, Parse was ahead of its time in a lot of ways. And one of those ways was architecturally. Like, you know, 2010, you know, people, we didn't have the language to talk about microservices and stuff back then, but we were doing a lot of those things. We were doing a lot of these things that are now very common, right, with platforms where you've got like these huge multi-tenant platforms, right? Where you may have hundreds of thousands or millions of customers, but every single one of them may have their own hundreds of thousands or millions of customers. And so the idea of solving these problems or even understanding these problems with metrics and aggregates is just bonkers. Like you can't. It's not even possible. You know, like we went through this whole thing at Parse where we built the platform on Ruby on Rails, which was great in the early days. You can build stuff super fast. And then we got to the point where, you know, we had real co-tenancy problems with a different app hitting the iTunes top 10 every day. And you couldn't predict, you know, it wasn't like the same things were just breaking in patterns anymore. You couldn't predict, you couldn't jump, you know, the old way of debugging used to be, yeah, you know, once in a while you have to track down a brand new problem from scratch. It would be excruciatingly hard, but at the end you'd be like, I'm going to build a dashboard for this so I can see it next time. And the next time it happens, you see the dashboard, you'd be like, cool, I can pattern match, right? What happens when you stop being able to pattern match? And we went through a real like valley of the shadow of death where Parse was down almost every day. Like it was personally humiliating to me as a reliability engineer, just how bad it was. We had to rewrite the entire system in Golang. We built all of this crazy stuff. But fundamentally, you know, we lacked the ability to even understand what was happening in our systems until we started feeding some data sets into this tool at Facebook called Scuba, which was it was not a fun tool. It was, I've often said, it's aggressively hostile to users, but it let you take high cardinality dimensions and wide events and slice and dice on them basically in real time. And so suddenly we were able to go, okay, break down by one, all of these app IDs, right? And then group by error counts. So you can see which apps have the most errors or by the sum of the latency. This was a huge game changer, being able to group by the sum of the latency for each. So like you can see if you know one app had like 2% of the requests, but was taking up like 60% of the time waiting on the database to return its queries, you know, because when you have these massively code, you know, high tenancy problems, it's really hard. It seems like it should be easy to figure out what's slow, but it's not, because when something gets slow, everything gets slow. And so just because there's a lot of hits for something when things are slow doesn't mean that that's what caused it being slow, right? And so we had like gradually gotten our shit into this tool, and the ability to like understand which app was, you know, causing the issue or what the problem was, like it went from taking days or weeks, or often we never understood it, down to like seconds. Like every time you just like slice and dice, just like break down, group by, oh nope, that's the one. Like it wasn't even an engineering problem anymore, it was like a support problem, and that it was game changing. Like I don't think we ever could have, you know, recovered from our issues with the tools available at the time without that. So when I was leaving Facebook, you know, I'm thinking about going to work at Slack or Stripe, and I kind of went, oh shit, like I actually can't imagine going back to work with metrics like Ganglia, right? Like G metrics and like all these dashboards and aggregates and stuff. And like, wow, how do people do this? Like, and so we decided to just kind of like try building a Scuba clone. Like Scuba is really like the great grandparent of Honeycomb, but it was really influential in how we built the storage engine, you know, because we there were a lot of things. Like it honestly took Christine and me, this is embarrassing, but it took us 2 or 3 years to really understand and explain what we had built and why it mattered so much and what mattered about it and what didn't. We just knew it did. But like the whole language of observability came out of, you know, those early years of just wrestling with why was this so different? Why was the experience so much better? I've been talking for a very long time now. I'm going to take a breath.
Yeah, this whole idea of you know, everything's you know, well, we just keep relying on metrics got me into so much trouble in the past. You spend half the time just figuring out, are you looking at the symptom or are you looking at the root cause? Yeah. And you have to, you know, do a lot of them, just okay, kind of just almost like you know, you look at some clue for the metrics, but you don't have the full picture. You don't have to, mm-hmm. you don't have the everything you need to figure out what actually happened. So you end up having to do a lot of additional logging and trying to correlate, when do I see those logs?
Timestamps, right?
Timestamps and the metrics, and do they match up? And then you sound like the roots of a detective work, because you don't have the right information at your fingertip. And once you have the right information, a lot of things just became so much easier, became obvious that, okay, that's what happened. And that is the, that's the root cause. And that's the symptom we're looking at right there. And this paradigm of looking at everything as an event and then aggregate them at the point of when you know what you're asking for, that's just how business analytics works. That's what we do, right? We collect loads of really fine grained events, and then we give tools to, you know, business analysts and let them figure out how to combine them and answer the question that they have at that moment in time. And I think it makes so much sense when it comes to us as engineers and looking at our system and trying to do this detective work and find out, okay, what actually happened and what were the things that was important that we should be aggregating on. And the funny thing is, Miss Splunk kind of had a similar model, but they were so expensive that they kind of just locked themselves out of the mainstream thinking. No one else was doing it, because they were the only one doing it, but they were so expensive. There's such a high barrier of entry for anyone to even discover this pattern, this way of working. So when the Honeycomb came out and started doing this thing, I just thought, oh wow, this is really cool. This, you know, finally someone is actually doing this at a price point that, you know, average people like myself and, you know, small startups can actually afford, which is pretty crazy.
No, totally. Like, and it's kind of crazy that someone hadn't done it sooner. You know, in the early days, we would often, struggling to explain this to people, we would often say exactly that. It's like BI, it's like, you know, business information for systems, right? And so engineers who had used BI tools would be like, oh, okay, obviously, I get it, right? And when I was talking about the early days, a lot of the Splunk guy could be like, this isn't new. We've been doing this all along. They're very indignant, right? And I'm like, cool, well, I didn't know about it. I didn't know about it. None of us knew about it, right? We're too poor to afford your premium tool, I guess. Yeah, but I also feel like there was, you know, I think the technical part was, this is a refrain, right? The technical part was the easier part. And the harder part was trying to figure out how to explain it to people in less than 30 minutes of talking, right? and trying to figure out how to make it click, you know, and so many of us, and I include myself in this, I had gotten so invested in being so good at knowing how to like squeeze the right data out of these kludgy sort of metrics and log solutions, right? You become a wizard, right? You're operating on part intuition and part, you know, past scar tissue, but like you're the only one who can come up with the answer because it's so fucking hard, right? And then somebody comes along, it's like, oh no, this is easy. Anyone can do it. Like there's a fair bit of resistance to that idea.
Yeah, and I think the early days, certainly when you were, when the early days of Honeycomb, when you were starting to talk about the observability, and I think at that point, everyone was still thinking about the metrics and logs. And I remember that the very first blog post I read about observability engineering from Twitter, it defines the four pillars. So that very much kind of fixated people's thinking,
yeah.
You know, and I think in general we have this problem of we you know, it's really hard to jump from the practices to the principles. And when there's something that's defined as okay, these are the four categories, the four pillars of observability, it's hard to think about okay, well, what is that? What is the thing that we're actually trying to do? So when you were talking about observability from the sort of control theories and the point of view in terms of being to infer what's going on in your system by just looking at its outputs, that suddenly just, you know, just like a light bulb moment for me that, okay, right, that makes sense. That makes me jump from the just looking at practice, what we do, to, okay, why are we doing it? You know, why we're not just doing logs and metrics. We're trying to figure out problems and answer questions that we don't know to ask today, you know, with the data that we've got.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and in the early days of of Honeycomb, we really thought this was going to be such a niche product just for platforms, because platforms have that sort of fractal quality of high cardinality. And what kind of surprised us was over the first course of the first year, just realizing how, oh no, everybody is having this problem, and at an escalating rate, because everybody is running, you know, it used to be you had the database, right? And now everybody's got like polyglot persistence, and now everybody's got lots of services. Now everybody's got, you know, containers that are blipping in and out of life all the time. And everybody's got, you know, customers who have their own customers and all this stuff. And that was the exciting point for me. I was like, oh, cool. Actually, we just got it. This is not a niche problem at all. We just got to peek around the corner at something that, I mean, you look now, like everybody's got all these problems.
Yeah, and certainly I think that the evolution of cloud and you know, certainly things like serverless technology means that teams are now smaller, they're more productive, which also means that more people have to get their hands on the system and you know, running it in production, understanding how it's working. So this problem of understanding your system and being able to debug it becomes a much broader scope than used to be just the backend guy sitting in the back of the room. No one knows what they're doing. All they've got is these logs that they can show off, whereas the front-end team is showing nice UIs. Now you've got full stack teams. Everyone has to chip in. Everyone has to know what's going on. So I think it becomes a much more universal problem now.
I think this is a huge part of it, is the shift towards, you know, really owning your code. And like I feel like most technical trends, is being driven by necessity. Like our systems have gotten so complicated that if you are writing the code, you're probably the only one who can really run it and debug it effectively. And you, if you're running the code, you also need to be able to write it. You know, you can't separate those disciplines anymore, because if you're writing code, you need that feedback loop. You need to be constantly being exposed to the consequences of what you've done. If those consequences are landing on someone else's neck, you're not going to write good code. And if you're out there trying to debug the system, treating it like black boxes, you're not going to be able to debug the system, right? And this is why I feel like, you know, I gave a talk recently where I was like, it's not that I hate when people are like, DevOps is dead. It's not, but the need for it might evaporate away over time, because I really feel like, you know, the whole dev/ops divide was, I'm not going to say a mistake, but a temporary aberration, let's say. As stuff had gotten too complicated for one person to do it all, right? So they're like, okay, let's split it up by writing and running. But that was never a stable situation, and it was never good for any of the people involved.
Yeah, that's I think DevOps is another one where we really struggle to separate what we do versus the principles, because the DevOps is never supposed to be, you know, a team or a title. It's a set of principles that we, you know, all we talk about is just, you know, things that we want to do to shorten the time between committing code to it running safely in production. That's what it was. But then that just became lost, and we lost
the battle for the DevOps term, just like we lost the battle for the observability term. You know, like for years I was like, you're defining it wrong, it means actually blah 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 blah, and you know, and like a bunch of people are like, yeah, but more people are like, we don't care. So observability now just means telemetry. I get it, it's fine. Shouldn't have been that way, but it's fine. We'll meet people where they're at.
that's sad. And the same thing keeps happening. Like Agile, that's another one. And Agile was never about Scrum or any of the things we've got today.
It's like, may you be lucky enough, may you be fortunate enough to see the thing that you cared about assimilated and no longer matter.
Yeah, I guess that's I guess that's a sign of success.
Sure.
Talking about, I guess, telemetry, one of the things that I also noticed is that Honeycomb was one of the early proponents for open telemetry. And that's something that's also been gaining a lot of, traction, and a lot of, even like AWS has started supporting open telemetry from CloudWatch, which I thought was really interesting turning point. Like, you know, going from like open standard to now big cloud providers that are actually stepping in and actually started implementing it. What are your thoughts on the current state of adoption for open telemetry? And I guess maybe for listeners who are not familiar with what it is, can you just spend a few moments and talk about, you know, what is it, why do we need it, and where we are right now?
Yeah. Open telemetry is something I was pretty cynical about. Liz Fong Jones was our internal champion for it. It's like, it's the descendant of what open tracing and, you know, other failed projects. But it's currently the second most, it's the second, I don't know how they measure it, but like after Kubernetes, it is the second biggest, most popular, most contributed to project in CNCF is open telemetry. And OTel was designed to basically make it so that you instrument your code once, and then you can go from vendor to vendor. Like, you shouldn't have to instrument your code again. Like, it's supposed to like remove vendor lock-in. It's supposed to liberate, like, every big vendor has, you know, hundreds of engineers devoted to nothing but integrations, right? With every conceivable language and framework and technology and all this stuff. And the idea is that by, you know, Ben Sigelman and the folks at Lightstep are the ones who originally kicked this off, and to their credit, like they got all the big vendors on board nominally. Datadog has not been a good team player, but the rest have been great team players. Got all the vendors on board with the idea that, you know, instead of all of us building our own little, you know, walled gardens, we contribute to an open standard, and we make it so that, you know, people can just, you know, the goal is that they should just be able to edit a few lines of configs and then move from vendor to vendor. It's not quite there yet, but it's gone a lot of the way towards that. It is, to my enormous surprise, succeeding. You know, there's a huge amount of momentum. And you know, I remember there was a tweet storm I did maybe 7 or 8 years ago about why are we so behind as an industry when it comes to, you know, logging and telemetry? And there's no standard. And like, why is it that every company is having to like design this from scratch everywhere? So like, there are some fair criticisms about OTel that it's like, you know, heavyweight and stuff, but it's as heavyweight as it needs to be in order to solve, you know, big problems for everyone. But it's getting a tremendous amount of traction. Like for a long time there, people who are coming to us, we would then sell them on OpenTelemetry. And now it's more like people who are interested in OpenTelemetry are coming to us, which is really exciting. But yeah, the idea is that you instrument your code using open standards, and then you're not locked into your vendors. Datadog is the only one who's just have to throw them a little shade because, you know, they're the elephant in the market. Of all the vendors, they should be the ones the least threatened by this. And in the beginning, you know, we submitted our libraries for consideration, and they were going to be accepted. But the Datadog's like, no, use ours. Use our integrations. And well, they had a broader install base, so we, you know, the OTel standard group accepted the Datadog integrations. And then Datadog started strong-arming people in their community to not submit integrations to OTel. Like, there was this guy, great guy, who submitted a collector to handle Datadog, you know, integrations for OTel. And they had their sales goons reach out to his boss and tell him to retract it. And they've been telling their customers internally that OpenTelemetry will be great someday, but it's not ready for prime time yet. It's their libraries. Those are their integrations that they're telling everybody not ready for prime time yet. So they're clearly not playing in good faith. Like, you can use OpenTelemetry to get your data into Datadog, but they're trying to make it hard for you to use your telemetry to get data out of Datadog to move to other providers, which is just shady. But my hope is that I know they've been getting a lot of pressure from their customers to you know, not do this. So I'm cautiously optimistic that in the long run they'll have to play ball. But yeah, it's great. It's a big step forward for the industry. It's an ambitious project. It's got a solid steering committee. It's got a solid technical foundation. And those of you out there who are not already planning this into your roadmap, it's time.
Yeah, it definitely feels it's something that you can't avoid at the moment because a lot of customers have been asking for it. Because when I hear about people trying to avoid the vendor lock-in, straight away my mind goes to, okay, you're just talking about everyone have to just settle for the least common denominator. So that's things like OpenTelemetry still leaves enough room for vendors to innovate, to do something different, like Honeycomb trying to do something different compared to a lot of the other vendors like Datadog.
Yeah. And the other thing I will say is that a project in this stage is a career maker. You know, there are engineers out there who are sometimes like, you know, like, what does it take to like be more well-known or to have a higher profile in the community? And there's no shame in that. I mean, you want what you want for your career. And if you want to be well-known for something, it's a great way to make sure you're always going to get jobs, right? And a project that's in this stage where it's proven itself, it's going to be around in 5 years, but it's still in the early stages where there's a lot of questions, there's a lot of code to be written, there's a lot of problems to solve, there's a lot of people who don't know much about it, and who, I mean, you carved out a niche like this for yourself with serverless, you know, years ago when it was in its early stages. You know, OpenTelemetry is another of those, you know, projects that can be a real career maker for ambitious engineers out there.
Yeah, definitely. And talking about career, one of the things that I also enjoyed reading from you is this problem that you talk about as the second half of your engineering career. A lot of people, once they reach the like age of 30 or maybe even 40, they start having to decide whether or not to chase after management title, or you know, where do they go from there? Because many companies don't have the sort of principal or staff engineering or technical fellow sort of title, so they kind of feel stuck at the sort of a senior developer sort of title, and there's no obvious progressions for them to make from that point. So what are your sort of advice for people who are at that point in their career and thinking about, okay, what are my choices and what are the, I guess, the pros and cons of becoming a manager? Because you wrote about, you know, what it's really like to be a manager and being a CEO of companies and why it's not for everybody.
Yeah, I think that's such a great question. And the first thing I'll say is, like, to be an engineer, a senior developer in your 30s in this industry, like, first of all, how privileged are we? Like I feel like we are more successful and happier to have more resources than, like, we're like the 0.001% of all people who have ever lived, right? It's a gift to have so many amazing choices to choose from, right? But it could also be kind of paralyzing, I think. And you're right, you do kind of get to a point where you're like, I've done this a few times. Where do I go from here? Everybody wants progression. Everybody wants to, you know, advance and learn things and you know, carve out a niche that I think is their own. And I think being a manager is a great opportunity. If people are willing to have you be their manager, then I think that being a manager for a couple of few years is a good move for a lot of engineers. But really, it depends on, you know, I feel like when you've been in the industry for a decade, you've reached the point where you really need to get to know yourself a little bit better, right? You've done all the right things, you know, you've leveled up, you've learned skills, and now you're at the point where it's like, the only expectations that matter are the expectations you have for yourself. So, like, are you interested in making sure that you preserve optionality, right? If so, then I think that going broad is the right answer. You know, have a lot of different experiences, you know, be somewhere for at least 5 years, and make sure you go really deep in something, but also pick up a new technology or like make sure that you're in a new challenging situation every 2 or 3 years. Try different industries, you know, you can also, like, join a larger company that has a more traditional sort of ladder for staff and principal and work your way up. But I think that the most important part is to keep checking in with yourself and going, am I having fun so much as am I really fulfilled by this? Because if you're not fulfilled by it, you've still got another 20, 30 years of career. So, like, I think that the reason people burn out is less often because of the amount of work that they have to do and more often because of the lack of investment they feel in that work. If it feels like work is being pushed on you by other people have expectations of you and you're doing it because you have to and you're working really hard, you get sick of it. You get tired of it. But if you can follow that little tendril of curiosity and find places where you feel more agency and more self-directedness, and you can kind of, you know, align that what interests you in what makes the business succeed, then, like, you know, yeah, you'll work hard sometimes and less hard sometimes, but it feeds that fire in you instead of just sort of like stamping it out day after day.
Yeah, that reminds me of I forgot what's the name of that that the pyramid of needs.
Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
That's it. Yeah, because once you've satisfied the basic physical needs, then the next level will be things like having autonomy of your life, agency in what you do.
Yes.
And I think most times when I hear people, you know, they're not happy with their job and leaving the job, it's not, again, like I say, it's not the job itself, but the lack of agency they feel in what they're doing, or control of their environment and their work, and they feel that they're not in control of what they're doing, and just like I said, things are being forced upon them to, okay, you just have to do this, you have no choice in the matter. And I think that's one big reason why people leave their jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. Autonomy, mastery, and purpose, right? That's what Dan Pink's book Drive says, that is what we all ask for from our work. And you know, we none of us ever have full autonomy. Well, maybe you do, like, you're a highly paid consultant now. You can just pick up and walk. I'm just kidding. I know you wouldn't. But, like, I think that, like, keeping in mind, because it gets so confusing and distracting. Like, there are so many variables. What am I pissed off about today? Right. It's probably not, I don't have enough purpose or autonomy, right? It's going to be something a little bit more concrete, right? But like, this is what vacations are good for, right? You take a step back and you're like, okay, I'm looking at my overall environment, and of course I'm not happy because I have no autonomy and I don't feel like there's any purpose to what I'm doing. So yeah, maybe I enjoy having mastery over my tools, but like, it's not feeding me. What would feed me more, right? And like taking steps to in that direction, because we humans are not that different from each other, from ourselves. You know, the wetware is the same.
Yeah, I totally agree. And speaking of hardware, one of the things that's obviously on everyone's lips right now is this whole AI, you know, craze, this AI hype. And one of the things that maybe not been talked about enough in this whole sort of Gen AI application development cycle is observability. And I was talking to someone on this podcast recently about the LangChain. And one of the things that came up in that conversation was how the LangChain team is developing these LangSmith tools for building observability for LLM applications. Before we sort of got on the podcast, you also mentioned that is that something that the Honeycomb is looking into? So what are you guys working on? Tell me.
So we released something a couple of months ago called a Query Assistant, which is amazing. Like, when you show up at Honeycomb, you know, blank slate, like, it's really challenging to just be dropped into like a query builder. There's all of this stuff and you're like, where do I start, right? And so we used LLMs to build this query builder thing where you could just use normal English language and be like, you know, so I just deployed this thing, what's slow, right? Or like, you know, you can just type in sentences and it will compose the query for you. And then you can tweak the query or you can, you know, generate a new one. It's really cool. It is such a great entry point into Honeycomb. And that really got us thinking after we spent my coworker, Philip Carter has been really geeky on this. If you're into LLMs, you owe it to yourself to read the series of blog posts that Philip has written on the honeycomb.io blog about LLMs, because he's been writing about his experience and what he's been discovering. And what excites me is that all of the principles about software engineering with LLMs, none of them are new. These are the same things we've been talking about for years about testing and production, right? Only production is production. You don't know if it works until you observe it in prod. Users bring chaos. There's no such thing as code that works, right? There's only confidence gained after baking in production over time. Failure will have, you know, all of these things. Are not just true about developing with LLMs. They're like ramped up to 1,000. Like, there is no such thing as like a unit test suite for your LLM code. There is only you running it a bunch of times on a set of data in production, looking at the results, you know, evaluating your confidence in them, evaluating whether or not that's a representative sample of the data set, figuring out how often that data set is changing, and then taking a sample and then using that as your quote unquote tests. Like, you can only test in production. And like, I think it's so exciting and fun. I think, you know, blah, blah, blah. I get so excited to start talking over myself, but like, you know, at Honeycomb, like, I feel like there's been such a shift over the past, even just 5 years of like better modern development principles and practices have been, you know, being adopted everywhere. Like, you know, not only testing in production, but engineers owning their code in production, separating deploys from releases using feature flags, you know, observability driven development, all of these things that cohere to accelerate the pace of development, like, radically. And it gets so much easier the faster that pace is, right? This is the thing that people think it's hard to ship code on like a 1 hour turnaround time. It's the easiest fucking thing in the world. It's hard to ship code that isn't going to be deployed for 6 months. That shit is hard, right? So you've got these things that are sort of accelerating, but they're not being adopted everywhere because there's so many, it's just a lot of culture change and mental change and process change and tool change. And what I think is so exciting is that we have a generation of software engineers who are all going to be working with LLMs over the next decade, all of them, which means that they're all going to get dropped into the deep end of the right way to develop software, period. And so it's not going to be off-putting or strange anymore to them. And they're going to start going, oh man, why can't I do this with my regular code too? Because it's so much easier and more reliable and better. And the good news is you can. So this is why I feel like LLMs, observability for LLMs, is really kind of like almost a Trojan horse, right? It's like, we're going to get you because you have to do it. But then you're going to realize how much easier and more fun and better and faster and great it is. And you're not going to want to give it up.
Yep, it's the gateway drug.
It's the gateway drug, exactly.
Proper software engineering practices.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's crazy how many customers I see they are still stuck in the 90s in terms of software engineering practices. Silo teams, they're not talking to each other. Big bang deployments every 6 months. CAB. And talking about proper production is production and deploying things frequently. Deploying on Fridays. I know you're a big fan. You often write about that. I've worked in environments where, that's just the norm. We deploy on Friday. And I've also worked in environments where, we have to go through a change approval boards every time we want to push something. There's a lot of, change freeze whenever we have a big event coming up, but we're not allowed to change anything. So in both environments, I've kind of, appreciate some of the reasons for that extra caution, especially when I hear some developers who are promoting the practice of deploying on Fridays. It almost sounds like, oh yeah, it's 4:59. I'm just gonna deploy my code and I'm just gonna.
Oh God! No! That's not what we're advocating at all. It's not about deploying on Fridays at all. For me, it's a smell, right? If you're like, okay, 20% of the week is too dangerous for us to deploy on, there should be a pretty big reason for that. Anytime you're deploying code, let's start with this, you should only deploy if you have the time to sit there and watch and wait and verify that it's working, right? You shouldn't deploy at 4:59 on any day if you plan on leaving at 5 p.m., right?
Yeah, I think that's the nuance that a lot of people just don't talk about.
Being
able to deploy means that you trust your system, your automation.
You own your shit, right? Like, okay, if you have perfect confidence that your change is fine and you can walk out the door, cool. But if something breaks, you're the one that's going to fix it, and you're going to get chewed out from not exercising good engineering judgment, right? This is about good engineering judgment. The other thing that I want, the other subtlety that I think gets lost in this, is that what I'm advocating is not that you make rules about when to deploy or not to deploy. It's really that as soon as you merge your code, you should assume it's going out. Right? You should assume it. Ideally, there would be some automated process that once you've merged, it runs all the tests and then it promotes it to production, right? The problem is that, and then you use your engineering judgment out when to merge, right? And that's where the judgment comes in. And then you wait, which is only possible with a fast deploy cycle, obviously. The problem is when you disconnect those, when you're like, I want to merge my code, I don't know when it's going to go out. Well, that's bad. Because the whole point is ownership, and that you need to be there to make sure that you're, so there's this whole hierarchy of things that need to be in place before you can just like deploy on Fridays. But they're all things that you should do. They're all things you should do anyway. It's almost like being able to deploy on Friday is the cherry that you get on top of your cupcake in order for, eating your vegetables. Because when you disconnect merging from deploying, you get a whole bunch of really pathological behaviors, like diffs just start to pile up and then a bunch of them get deployed at once at some unknown point in the future when none of those developers are watching. And then when something breaks, you don't know which of those diffs was at fault, right? So like, this is an argument for tightening up all of that and executing good engineering judgment, not for just being like, YOLO.
Yeah, that's kind of going back to the DevOps principles again, about being able to shorten that time between pushing
it's
it.
everything.
Yep.
And I get it. Like, our jobs are complicated. The world is complicated. Teams are complicated. I think of a lot of engineering leaders get paralyzed by that and they start just firefighting, right? And so they're like, you know, they're like, oh, well, our code review turnaround time is too long. So let's attack that problem. Or, you know, our tool chain isn't, you know, let's attack that problem. These are all symptoms and pathologies. You know, if you want to improve your team's performance, their quality of life, and your software's quality, you need to focus on one thing. Focus on shortening that interval and tightening that ownership loop so that you merge your code and it gets deployed and you look at it and you don't walk away from your desk until you've closed that loop and verified that your code is working. Solve that, and almost all of these pathologies and symptoms, it gets solved upstream from them. They never have a chance to proliferate, right? The whole, like, review turnaround time thing. Well, you know, it reviews are turnaround in a long time if diffs are long. Diffs are long if reviews turnaround time is long, right? Like, all of these things just kind of, like, you're either in this, I think, like, it's software engineering death spiral of everything getting longer and slower and taking more time and taking more people and resources, or you have some discipline and you kind of fix it at the source and you keep that cycle really tight.
Yeah, I agree. And that the whole thing about after you deploy something, just sit there and make sure that it's actually okay before you walk away. That's such a
instrument your
simple
code
thing.
As you're writing it, and then you look at it through the lens of the instrumentation you just wrote. Like, you should never deploy code that you can't go then and look at that instrumentation and say, is it working as I expected it to? Does anything else look weird? If you can't answer those questions, you shouldn't have deployed that code. You should not have, that instrumentation was not sufficient, right? The one thing I know we're out of time, but the one thing I want to say is that I hear from a lot of people who hear all this stuff and they're like, oh yeah, wouldn't that be nice? You know, but, like, you know, we couldn't do that here. Or, like, you know, the saddest thing that I hear is when people are like, that's only for really great teams. Of course you can do that. You work with all these great engineers, right? Ex Google, ex Facebook, ex all these things. And, like, that is so sad. And it is so not true. It is so not true. It, like I said before, it is so much easier to work with a short cycle time than with a long cycle time. It is hard to work with a long cycle time. Every engineer out there who is capable of instrumenting their code and debugging it in production, every engineer out there who has had to, you know, if you can't debug anything in production, okay, start there, sure. But, like, you all are capable of this, and it's not that hard, and it just takes baby steps. You just plug away at it, shorten that cycle, and everything else will fall into place, I promise you.
That reminds me of something that Kent Beck said, that people think he's a great engineer, but he thinks himself as a good engineer with great habits. So once you start building those great habits, you can be, you know, just as good as any of the engineers that you think, you know, that's so good that they can do all these things.
Exactly. I love that quote. I have a similar one, which is that great engineers are made by great teams where they learn those great habits. You know, at Honeycomb, we don't try to hire the most brilliant software engineers. We're not even trying to hire great software engineers. We're trying to hire good software engineers who are great teammates. Because ultimately, the smallest unit of ownership is not a person, it's a team. And you need to be constantly improving together in little ways every day.
Yeah, what's the name of the Google research project about the team success rate? And they found that the number one predictor for team success was not about the individual, but just about the team safety, how safe people feel with each other. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's called the Phoenix Project or something. I never remember. The other thing that I loved from that project was the anecdote that, you know, she started by watching all of these doctors, and she found that the highest performing doctors reported the most errors. Counterintuitive, right? But it's because they felt safe with each other to just be like, this didn't work, this didn't work, this didn't work. And, you know, they had trained themselves not to brush over those things, but to really notice them and, like, keep hold themselves honest. I think about that almost every day.
Yeah, isn't there like a saying in the Silicon Valley or something that you learn more from failures than you do from successes?
Absolutely.
So this is very much the theme to openly talk about failures and what you can learn from that is a very very valuable way to grow.
Yeah. I feel like, it's not like all engineers have achieved this everywhere by any means, but like the practice that of blameless retros that we've all been kind of like drilling into ourselves for the past decade and a half. I know I look at other teams that haven't, other parts of the company that haven't had that history, and there's so much trauma there. People are so afraid to, we're all naturally kind of afraid to be like, oh, this didn't work. But like, I feel like the process of like retraining ourselves to celebrate failures, to like be like, oh my God, you found that. Thank you. Right? Is something that, it's a question of life or death for companies that really want to succeed.
Yeah, agreed. So, Charity, thank you so much for your time today. And
It
I've
was
really
great
enjoyed this
catching up with
conversation, and I've
you.
always learned something from you.
Same. I hope to catch up with you again soon.
Yeah, hopefully, I'll catch you in person sometime soon. But yeah, so everyone, thank you very much for listening to this podcast. I will put those links to the Honeycomb blog post about the Query Builder, as well as more information about the OpenTelemetry, as well as some of Charity's firestorm tweets about deploying on Friday and things like that on the description below. So you can go and have a look at those afterwards. So yeah, Charity, thank you so much. Yeah, hope to see you in person sometime soon.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. So that's it for another episode of Real World Serverless. To access the show notes, please go to realworldserverless.com. If you want to learn how to build production-ready serverless applications, please check out my upcoming courses at productionreadyserverless.com. And I'll see you guys next time.